So this is Monday, November 7. Okay, excellent. In Biochem 421. Let's pray, shall we? Dear Lord, thank you so much for the rain that's coming. Prepare the earth and its living things that imbibe it, live in it, and get them ready for the winter to come. Lord, we are grateful for this miracle of life. We're grateful also that the semester is nearly over, 3 more weeks, and we're basically going to be done. And we are looking forward to these next few weeks at some of the most interesting biochemistry that we're going to do is this last 3 weeks. Thank you so much for loving us, giving us this day. In Jesus' name, amen. That's right, interesting biochemistry. And oddly enough, it goes pretty quickly, too. You'd think, and we're actually going to start catching up a little bit on this stuff because it is so relatively, it all is relatively straightforward. So we're looking at overhead number 4 here on chapter 14. We're going to finish up chapter 14 today, begin chapter 15. I will load the rest of the lectures starting tonight, I hope, during Monday Night Football. And Monday Night Football, anybody know who's playing tonight? Anybody care? Oh, the Bears are? Oh, that'll be, who are they playing? Anybody I care about? The who? Eagles? Okay. Well, at any rate, did the Lions win this last week? Oh, it was a bye week for them? Oh, okay. Maybe Adamakin Sue can get his temper under control. But be that as it may. All right. Common intermediates and metabolites, ladies and gentlemen. We see major metabolic functions, the eukaryotic organelles. I need for you to be able to, if you haven't already just from sheer practice, I need for you to be able to commit to memory the major functions of these subcellular organelles and, commit the function and the organelle together. Some of them are fairly straightforward, but like the mitochondria and the cytosol are among the most complicated because lots of things are happening in there. Notice you have in mitochondria, citric acid cycle, electron transport, oxidative phosphorylation, fatty acid oxidation, amino acid breakdown. Ooh. Then you have, under cytosol, you have glycolysis, pentose phosphate pathways in the cytosol, fatty acid biosynthesis, many reactions of gluconeogenesis. I want to point out to you one thing that is interesting, the physical separation of fatty acid metabolism. Fatty acid metabolism has oxidation in the mitochondria, but synthesis in the cytosol. The fatty acid oxidation occurs logically in the mitochondria because that's where much of the energy protection of the cell occurs, and fatty acid oxidation is where you get a tremendous amount of energy. Then you have the lysosome, of course, which is enzymatic digestion of cell components. The nucleus, of course, DNA, RNA. Golgi apparatus, translational processing of membrane and secretory proteins, formation of plasma membrane and secretory vesicles. So this is where that occurs. Of course, post-translational processing of membrane and secretory proteins primarily means all the carbohydrate processing that goes on there. Carbohydrate processing or processing. Rough endoplasmic reticulum sits the membrane-bound protein, smooth, the lipid and steroid biosynthesis in the smooth. And finally, the peroxisome or glyoxysome in plants. Oxidative reactions catalyzed by amino acid oxidases and catalyzes glyoxylate cycle reaction. In plant, glyoxylate cycle reactions in plants, primarily seeds. Seeds. We'll get to seeds here. Seeds are a unique situation. So, what organelle converts fat into carbohydrate in your body? What organelle converts fat into carbohydrate in your cell, in your body? Liver is an excellent choice. It's incorrect, of course, but it's an excellent choice. Actually, name another organelle. Any tissue. Intestines, incorrect. Name another tissue. Pancreas, incorrect. Name another tissue. Lungs, incorrect. Heart, incorrect. Muscle tissue, incorrect. What did I just say? Converts fat into carbohydrate? You can't do it. There is no mechanism in your body that converts fat into carbohydrate, and don't ever forget it. I apologize for the trick question, but only a little. There is nothing in your body that converts it. You can convert carbohydrate into fat into carbohydrate under one circumstance only, and that's if you consumed an odd chain fatty acid. And then after its conversion, after its oxidation in two fatty acid units, you end up with a three carbon unit, and that unit can be converted into carbohydrate. Otherwise, nothing. Anyway, just thought I'd throw that out at you, and don't ever forget it. All right, let's go ahead here, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? Thermodynamics. And could somebody tell me where this ends? Substrate cycles? One more? All right. Thank you very much. Let's fill in the blanks, if you don't mind. The very first blank is on the right-hand side of the overhead at concentrations. Next blank is reversible. Next blank is controlled. Next blank down there, over halfway down the page, is called pathway becomes irreversible. First committed step. And third there is sum. How are the rate-controlling enzymes? Allosteric control, covalent modification, substrate controls, genetic control. So it's allosteric, covalent, substrate, and genetic. All right. Now, what does thermodynamics do? Does thermodynamics tell us how fast a chemical reaction will occur? Will thermodynamics tell us how fast a chemical reaction will occur? No. Will it tell us if a chemical reaction will occur? Yes, indeed. So, you can, not surprisingly, have a situation where an enzyme can, in fact, be reversible. When you recall the enzymes of gluconeogenesis, you saw that there are only four unique enzymes in gluconeogenesis. Otherwise, there's a glycolysis. Reversible reactions of glycolysis. So you have both a forward and reverse pathway, depending on the equilibrium setup. Enzymatic reactions near equilibrium have net rates controlled by simple relative concentrations of the substrates and products. So many enzymes that are near equilibrium, it's simply a matter of which side has more, the products or reactants. If there's a higher concentration of products, boom, it reverses. However, there are a few enzymes that are far from equilibrium. The flux. Anybody idea what I mean by flux? It's the total amount of mass through a pathway over time. The total, or actually net, amount of mass through a pathway over a period of time. Because the flux includes both the forward and reverse rates, the net of those two. Controlled by a few enzymes in a pathway, typically at the beginning, these enzymes typically are far from equilibrium, which means they are rate-controlling enzymes. Enzymes far from equilibrium are typically not reversible, as I back up here. They act like a dam in the pathway, like a dam, easily controlled. The main purpose of a dam in a river is twofold. What's the main purpose of a dam in a river? If you're going to dam a river, you're going to do it for two reasons. And what are the two reasons? What? I am deaf. One more time.
Hold back the water.
Okay. Yeah, hold back the water. That is the obvious thing. Exactly. Hold back the water. Hold back the water from what? Primarily, flood control. And secondarily, actually, power generation. That's why you have a dam on a river. And so you have this river, you have the dam, and notice the height difference between where the water is here and the water outlet That is a delta E that can be captured as energy. In a cell, you have, you have you got PEP and pyruvate, and what is the dam here? This is the enolase or pyruvate kinase. What's the last step on glycolysis? Is it pyruvate kinase? Come on. Someone look it up. Don't tell me we've all forgotten it in the last few weeks. Guess what question is going to be on the next test then? What's at the bottom of glycolysis? Glycolysis. Yes. She frantically looks it up for me. Have we all lost our minds? I was counting on you folks to be able to help me out here with that. What? It's pyruvate kinase, isn't it? Enolase is before that to produce phosphine pyruvate. Anyway, this is pyruvate kinase. Pyruvate kinase. So, what is the delta E? Delta E here, of course, an enzyme produces ATP. The delta E in a dam produces electricity, which is handy dandy. We all like electricity. And we all need it. So you can see here the big difference is this. And so having that large scale difference allows for flood control. Flood control. In other words, that as a big bolus of water comes through here, the dam gradually fills and prevents a flood downstream. Many of the dams on the upper Mississippi are flood control dams and shipping dams. But a lot of dams in the West are simply for power. The Hoover Dam there in the Grand Canyon, just outside the Grand Canyon, is for power primarily. Although they've had a long-term drought, and the dam is way down. The dam, the height of the water around the dam is way down. At any rate, so what this means is flood control means at high differences in energy, large energy differences, allow for control, just like a dam. It allows you to control the flux through it. All right, so but that's only if there is this, what did I say? Fluxes, these are far from equilibrium. This is not an equilibrium situation here, okay? If you want to go upstream, can you pass directly through the dam? No, you have to find another pathway around it. You have to portage around it. In the same way, if you have an enzyme that goes from B to C through the enzyme F, and that is a large energy difference, that if you want to go backwards, you don't simply reverse F, you find a new pathway to do that, which is what happens with gluconeogenesis and glycolysis. There are four enzymes that provide a new pathway going from pyruvate up to glucose. What are the four enzymes of gluconeogenesis? I think we've read that once already. Starting at the bottom, what converts pyruvate into oxaloacetate? Nope, pyruvate kinase is this thing. You go from a 3-carbon unit to a 4-carbon unit. That's pyruvate carboxylase. Then you have oxaloacetate goes to PEP, and that, of course, is that 5-letter designation. PEPCK. What does PEPCK stand for? Phosphoepyruvate carboxykinase. And then you go all the way. Then everything else is reversible all the way back. Even aldolase. I find that remarkable. Aldolase is remarkable. It goes back up to fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. The phosphate gets knocked off through fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase, which is an enzyme. And the last one is glucose 6-phosphatase. All right. Well, anyway. So, rate-controlling enzymes produce the following effects. The pathway becomes irreversible. The pathway is a flux at first committed step, yet the overall flux can be the sum of two opposing pathways. So, this is reversible through this irreversible through this enzyme, but you can still find a way around it using a different enzyme. And this is the first committed step, is typically very early in the pathway. You don't want control late in the pathway, but early in the pathway. And typically the flux is the sum of the overall. Well, how are the rate-controlling enzymes self-controlled? Allosteric control. Glycogen phosphorylase is allosterically controlled. Allosterically controlled. Name a small compound that allosterically controls glycogen phosphorylase. ATP, exactly. Covalent modification. What moiety, what group is added to glycogen phosphorylase to control it covalently? What is the group that's added to it or removed to it? What is it? Phosphate, that's correct. Are there others? Yes, there are others. It's turning out that even acetyl groups and some of the substrate cycles. Take this line and point over here. This is a substrate cycle. In which you can have a forward and reverse reaction occurring simultaneously. Allosteric control is this thing down here where you've got the product comes back and feedback inhibits the first enzyme of the pathway. And genetic control, of course, is the amount of synthesis versus breakdown. Synthesis versus degradation of the enzyme. All right. Where do I end here? Is it after C? One more? Okay. All right. Now, overhead number 6, energy transduction of catabolic pathways. ATP is the great energy intermediate. It is a high-energy compound, but nevertheless, it's not the highest energy compound in the body. Okay? So, for example, when you look at this table here, what appears to be the highest carbohydrate, highest energy carbohydrate in the body? What's the name of it? What's it say in that table? Phosphoenolpyruvate is the highest energy compound in the highest energy carbohydrate in the body. Highest energy. And of course, what's the abbreviation for it? PEP. I can't tell you how many times I've been tempted to synthesize PEP and sell it at a natural food store. If you want more energy, if you want more pep, buy phosphoenolpyruvate by Dave Novak. Thank you very much. Contact me on my Learjet. I'll be flying to the south of France as people buy this stuff without thinking about it. Will this have any particular effect? No, you're just buying very, very expensive, and thank you very much, very, very expensive carbohydrate. All right. But nevertheless, it is what it is, isn't it? Is it not the highest energy compound in the body? Is its name not abbreviated PEP? I mean, it's waiting for somebody to sell it, okay? Except there are even hucksters have some pride, I guess. Anyway, so you can go through it. Here's another one. I like this phosphocreatine. Phosphocreatine is what's known as an ATP buffer in your muscles. The first 5 or 10 seconds of any high energy exertion by muscle groups is typically buffered. The ATP use is buffered by phosphocreatine, because it can quickly, and I mean almost instantaneously, be converted into ATP, or its high energy can convert it into ATP. So any burst of energy that you might have or high muscle activity comes from phosphocreatine. And there are muscle builders that consume phosphocreatine as a mix in some amino acids and stuff. If you're a bodybuilder, I'm sure you've heard about eating phosphocreatine or some commercial variety of that. That all goes down to ATP, and that all eventually ATP can then be made, can attach itself the phosphorus can attach itself to glucose or glycerol and make some other intermediates. So you see there another table. Phosphoenolpyruvate has the highest delta G, 61. There's ATP to ADP. There's one that goes to AMP, which is a slightly higher energy. ATP to ADP gets a slightly lower. But next down here, you have many low energy intermediates. Where does ATP get its energy from? So this is now looking at the very details of energy within the molecule. Its hydrolysis is more stable than its original structure. So write in stable. The next blank is absent. Third blank is less. And hydrolysis, the blank, is thermodynamically favored, but kinetically disfavored. ATP hydrolysis is thermodynamically favored, but kinetically disfavored. So, here you go. Its hydrolysis products are more stable than its original structure. In other words, when you look at the structures here, for example, on the right-hand side, see this diagram where they have a possibility of simultaneously shifting electrons. When you break that, you have more options for where the electrons can reside. You have more options for the electrons where they can reside, and so that decreases the resonance energy or increases the resonance stabilization. Charge repulsion, if you notice here, what's the charge of ATP? What's the total number of negative charges there on ATP? 1, 2, 3, and 4. It's a -4. What's the typical counter ion to this? You can't have just a lot of this accumulated in the body without having the counter ion, a positive ion next to it. What's the typical counter ion to it? If you recall the glycolytic pathway, many times you see when ATP is being used, there's also what? Magnesium ion. That's absolutely correct. And it's the counter ion of choice in biological, at least in human mammalian physiology. Okay, so there's four right there in a row, and boy, they don't like each other, and the only thing that's holding them together is the strength of those phospho and hydride bonds. They do not like it. Solvation energy is less with the ATP than its hydrolysis products. In other words, that there's fewer solvation molecules around ATP than there is ATP plus its products. Now, what does this word mean? The ATP hydrolysis is thermodynamically favored but kinetically disfavored. How would you draw that on a diagram? Write this diagram down somewhere, please, in this overhead. Here you have energy. Here you have reaction coordinate. Here you have the ATP. Down here you have ADP plus PI. Now, just drawing it like this, indicating this is, does this show thermodynamic favorability or kinetic favorability? Thermodynamic. Just the difference in the energy heights show thermodynamic favorability. This is endothermic or exothermic? Exo, thank you very much. Now, does this say anything about the rate of the reaction as it moves between there? No, it does not. Can I draw something in there that might give us a hint about the rate of the reaction? Now then, those two peaks, do they give us any hint about the possible kinetics of the reaction? What is it? Yeah, one's uncatalyzed, perhaps, and the other's catalyzed. That's correct. But the energy difference, this E, what? Act, is related to the speed, rate. And so having a high energy of activation, does that speed or slow the reaction? So having a low energy of activation does what? Speeds it. Yep, at least it's related to that, certainly directly. Well, of course, the energy of activation is not anything like that. But let's take a look at the uncatalyzed version of this. And I apologize for the crude drawing. But anyway, this certainly indicates that there's a fairly significant energy of activation that must be mounted before the reaction can continue. This is the kinetic disfavorability. The difference in energy is the thermodynamics favorability. The energy of activation is the kinetic disfavored. Okay. What is one reason why they don't like nitroglycerin? Because it's shock sensitive. It's a liquid. Nitroglycerin literally is glycerin that's got nitrates on it. And it's shock sensitive. So is TNT, which is trinitrotoluene. A little bang on the bottle, and you, the bottle, the horse, the wagon, and it's all gone. Horse, wagon, what in the world are you talking about? In the early days of oil production in Pennsylvania and in western Oklahoma, the oil is relatively close to the surface, but nevertheless, when they drilled down, they just had a little well, just had a hole this big that the oil could seep into. So they would pour nitroglycerin or trinitrotoluene, TNT, down the hole and set it off to blow a cavern underground for the oil to seep in so they could pump it out. Not unlike what they're doing with fracking today on the oil shale. So the technology is nothing new with the oil shale fracking. But they would hire, they would make the trinitrotoluene on site. They'd literally get benzene, they'd get toluene, they'd get nitric acid, and they get sulfuric acid as a catalyst, and they'd make it right there on site. They'd make these quart or gallon bottles of TNT. You would then put this TNT on a wagon, just the wagon, that was carefully supported. And they would hire these young men that were not married and old horses, and they would drive this TNT to the well site. Well, 9 times out of 10, it was fine, but there was a pretty good percentage that something would go wrong. The horse would fail or get spooked, or something would fail in the wagon. And the shock would sent the TNT off, and there would be nothing but a hole left in the ground. The wagon would be gone, the horse would be gone, the young man would be gone. Name the person who controlled TNT by wrapping it in by mixing it with diatomaceous earth, which is crushed coral, by soaking it in that and then wrapping it in paper. By the way, when you do that, when you wrap it in paper, what do you have? You have this stick of dynamite. Name the person who invented that to control trinitrotoluene. A guy named Alfred Nobel. The Nobel Prize is named after the man who invented dynamite and controlled TNT. He felt so guilty about the death and destruction that his control of that explosive wreaked on civilization due to war and stuff, that he set up these Nobel Prizes. And the money from the Nobel Foundation, which is still coming in from dynamite, is funding all these Nobel Prizes, including the one for peace. At any rate, that's Alfred Nobel. So, TNT, the whole purpose of this was to say, TNT, of course, had a high energy, high thermodynamic favorability, but a very low energy of activation. You couldn't control it. Well, ATP can be controlled. You can make it and actually have it exist in your cell for longer than a fraction of a second, because in order to overcome that high energy of activation, there has to be an enzymatic release of the ATP. That these bonds right here do not spontaneously break, although you would think they would given the amount of energy compressed in them. So there is an enzymatic need for ATP to have that. If you ever get a disease or a virus that releases an enzyme that just spontaneously breaks down ATP in your body without doing anything useful, you're dead. In not a very long order either. But at any rate, that's the whole idea between that. We'll keep going ahead. Coupled reactions, this means that, let's see here, how far down do I go? ATP buffer? Okay. Thank you very much. I want you to notice something here. We're going to start here in the middle. Okay, well, the blanks are endergonic at the top. This is overhead number 7. Endergonic, exergonic is the next blank. Next blank is substrate level. Substrate. Next blank is oxidative. Oxidative. Last one is photophosphorylation. And thank you very much, Lord, for making photophosphorylation. Appreciate it very much. Then that the photophosphorylation. And the last blank is buffer. Buffer, buffer. I think I mentioned already phosphocreatine. Let's take a look at the middle. The average person regenerates 1.5 kilograms of ATP per hour. You are constantly recycling ATP. Your body could not make enough ATP to regenerate the whole molecule all the time. ATP to ADP, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. The average ATP molecule gets used 600 times in a day. 600 times in a day. That's why it's 1.5 kilograms of ATP. Well, how do you make that? Well, you link. Why do you recycle it? You link the endergonic reactions, which require energy. You link it with exergonic reactions, which release energy. Let's take a look here at something. For example, here's this is we're going to take a look at the table on the right-hand side of the overhead. Endergonic half reaction, you got phosphate plus glucose makes glucose 6-phosphate. It takes energy to do that, 13.8 kilojoules per mole. The other half reactions, you have high energy ATP plus water, hydrolyzing that inorganic phosphate gets linked to the glucose. That releases 30 kilojoules per mole, and the net is 16, negative 16.8. So that drives the reaction forward. So here you have another situation where you have phosphatidylpyruvate hydrolyzing to pyruvate. That releases 61 kilojoules per mole. Well, here's the ADP adding the phosphate to it to make ATP. That costs 30.5, which is, if you draw an arrow up here, that's where that energy comes from. And you have a net release, net inefficiency of minus 31. So that huge inefficiency drives the reaction forward to make sure that you make plenty of ATP out of it. So you lose about half of your energy when you hydrolyze phosphatidylpyruvate to pyruvate. You lose about half of it as heat, oddly enough. You are warm, is that correct? You are a warm-blooded animal. And part of that energy comes from the inefficiencies of this process, where this excess energy, yes, is used to drive the process forward, but at the end of the whole process, these molecules are vibrating at a slightly higher rate because of the excess energy they have than before. That vibration, of course, is heat. All right, so you take this high energy releasing molecule of reaction, you link it to an energy requiring reaction, and the energy requiring reaction then occurs. You then use that in another reaction that requires energy, and there's this constant regeneration and use of ATP. How do you get that ATP bound to the ADP? Well, there's three different ways. The first is called substrate-level phosphorylation. That's the classic thing that happens in glycolysis in the last half. That's substrate-level phosphorylation, where the high-energy molecule is directly linked through the enzyme to the production of ATP. That's this thing right here. Phosphatidylpyruvate going to pyruvate is intimately linked with the production of ATP. This is the classic substrate-level phosphorylation. Oxidative phosphorylation uses what? You know, what is it? ATP synthesis, which of course occurs in the electron transport system, which occurs in the mitochondria. So oxidative phosphorylation uses the electron transport system to pump protons to go through the ATPase and all that. Photophosphorylation, of course, that uses chlorophyll and so on. One of these things that are right here, this is an ATP buffer I've mentioned earlier already. Phosphocreatine is a high-energy molecule that exists. You have small stores in your major muscle groups, and as you begin to use them for high energy, for sudden exertion, the creatine combines to make this stuff, the creatine binds with the ATP under the influence of creatine kinase to make phosphocreatine. But under the reverse reaction, under high need of ATP, this reverse reaction occurs quickly, and you can make lots of ATP very quickly, but you only have limited amounts of phosphocreatine in your body at any given time. And so it doesn't last very long, but it certainly is important. And this is an ATP buffer that you find in your cells. What other high-energy intermediates are there in the body besides ATP and this phosphoinositol pyruvate? Well, there's plenty of them, actually. One of the most important that you find here is this acetyl-CoA enzyme A. If you don't mind pointing to it, is one of the few sulfur carbon bonds. It's one of the few thioester bonds. So point at that bond right up there and say thioester. Thioester. So acetyl-CoA has a thioester bond to it because of the sulfur connected to the acetyl group. And you've got this mercaptoethylamine group. And then here, oh, look at this, pantothenic acid residue that connects it to the ADP, the rest of the molecule. And that whole thing then, once it has acetyl group, is called acetyl coenzyme A. So the coenzyme A uses an important vitamin called pantothenic. Pantothenic acid is a vitamin. It's a nutritional material. Of course, it's one of the cheapest vitamins available because it's so ubiquitous. You can get it everywhere. So, of course, as you know, acetyl-CoA is used in carbohydrate metabolism. But they also use it commercially in shampoos. Why do they use it in shampoos? Because they want to sell you a shampoo that has vitamins in it. Whether those vitamins actually have any real use is irrelevant. Does it hurt to cut your hair? No. Because your hair is what? Dead. Do dead things need vitamins? So why are you putting vitamins in your hair through pro-vitamin B van Pantene or all this very expensive stuff? Okay, putting vitamins on your hair to help your hair is kind of like rubbing sugar on your stomach to gain weight. Okay? It's not going to happen. All right? Oh, I need to gain weight, so let me rub some fat and sugar on you. I'll rub an Oreo on my stomach. Boy, I feel weight gain already. The shampoos are good because they use expensive ingredients to help modify the behavior of hair, but there is no need to put any pantothenic acid in it. But it's a marketing tool and it's harmless, so it's okay. Now, what else? So this is a high-energy thioester. The oxidation reduction is also very important. It produces temporary high-energy intermediates. You're familiar with the names of these at least, NAD and FAD. I want you to note here the NAD portion, whether it's NAD plus or NAD P plus, only handles electron pairs at a time. You can't handle one electron at a time. NADs only deal with electron pairs. The FADs can handle one electron at a time and find more use in a variety of different locations besides electron energy transduction. But NAD is primarily an energy transducer. Energy transducer. So here you have NAD going to NADH, and there's that pair of electrons that got added to the NADH, and it simply cycles back and forth between that NAD plus form and the hydride form, and that hydride then is used as a resource or a location for electrons. You see here now, you've got the flavin adenine dinucleotide, FAD. You can see here where you can add one hydride at a time to make a variety of different reduced intermediates that can be used for a variety, too numerous to mention, of uses within the body. But nevertheless, it's used as an oxidation reduction transducer between one reaction that needs electrons to one action that produces electrons. It goes through FAD if it uses one at a time, or NADH or NAD if it uses two at a time. Here you see where the entire molecule FAD is shown here. Here's the flavin structure. Here's the adenine structure. And then there's a ribitol, or a 5-carbon alcohol there, that connects the two. Riboflavin, which is typically the material that you eat. That's the vitamin. And then you add adenosine and you've got this stuff going on here. Oxidation reduction is extremely important in the body, as you can imagine, as you move electrons from glucose onto NADH, and that NADH goes to the electron transport system and produces energy. So how do you understand that? What's the chemistry of it? What's the general chemistry of it? Okay. So here you see, this is just this is an educational slide to help remind you of oxidation reduction. Let's quickly run through this. You have +3 and a +1 can become a +2 and a +2, where electrons are shifted from the copper onto the iron. Okay. And so you have the reduction piece and you have the oxidation piece. So if I was going to circle this, if I was going to circle one of these ions and ask you, circle the oxidizing agent, which ion would you circle? Which one would you circle here would be the oxidizing agent? Which one would be this? Which one would you circle as being the oxidizing agent? Yes, iron 3 is the oxidizing agent. Which one is the reducing agent? Copper. Which one? Copper. Copper plus, just plus 1 there. You can divide the reduction reactions, oxidation reactions. You can do that separately in two different compounds, two different solutions. You can have the oxidation in one and the reduction in the other, and the electrons have to travel between the two. And if you have appropriate circuitry, you can follow the electrons moving between the two with the salt bridge allowing for electrical neutrality, and you can see a volt there. So there is a certain level of activity between iron and copper that's beyond the scope of this discussion, deals with the very essence of the different elements. And so copper is a higher energy than iron, and so copper will move from the electron of the copper will move to the iron. What kind of electron, how can we, since we have a voltage being produced here, that means we are able to do work, that means there's free energy available. We can see then that if we know the voltage change and the amount of electrons being moved per mole, we can get a free energy amount. How much free energy is available to do work? You can see that here. You can also link it to the various concentrations, the oxidation reduction half cells, and then you can put them eventually together in this form. Delta E is equal to change of voltage electron acceptor minus the electron donor. All right. So we can use that delta E here to figure out the free energy. The delta E here we can figure out to do the free energy. I took this quote directly from the text. The more positive the standard reduction potential, the higher the affinity for the electrons couples for the oxidized form of the electrons. That is, the greater tendency for the redox couples oxidized form to accept electrons and then become reduced. The more positive the standard reduction potential, the more likely it is to want to be produced or reduced, pardon me. Let's take a look at this. Yeah?
What does delta E stand for?
Delta E stands for the change in voltage between the two half cells. Change in voltage between the two half cells. So you have a standard voltage here relative to hydrogen gas, and you have a standard voltage here relative to hydrogen gas, and the difference between those two standard voltages that you can obtain through a table, people have laboriously figured out that table, is the delta E. And that delta E then combined with the number of electrons and the Faraday constant will tell you how much free energy is being released per mole. We'll take a look at this. We're actually going to do a simple reaction, I hope, if we can do this. Let's take a look at this. What is the most oxidizing, what has got the highest oxidizing potential in this, what is, yeah, in this table? What's at the top?
Oxygen.
What's the most reduced? This acetate to acetaldehyde. If you could link this directly with oxygen reduction, you'd get the maximum amount of power out of it. All right, but it's the difference between these oxidation potentials, some of which are positive and some of which are negative. It's the difference between the two positions that tell us how much energy you can extract as free energy. For example, here, if here is NAD plus going to NADH, he's got a negative 0.315 value. If we link it, however, to, for example, this fumarate and succinate, if we link it to that, we see we get a positive voltage of 0.035, and the difference between that is the amount of energy we can get out of it. Unfortunately, that fumarate and succinate, actually, if you recall from the citric acid cycle, that one is where you get FAD out of it, as opposed to NAD. So you have this process. Let's take a look. How can we use this and what we've just learned to get some useful information out of it? And here is an overhead taken directly from your text. I suggest you review it for the future. Calculation: the delta G for the oxidation of NADH by FAD. Combining the relevant half reactions gives the reduced NADH plus the oxidized FAD plus the hydrogen ion gives you the oxidized and reduced. Is that favorable or unfavorable? One way you can do this is to use the equation on 411, and that is electron acceptor minus donor. Since these are the standard voltages, you get these numbers here from the table. So FAD is the electron acceptor, and NADH is the electron donor. Therefore, the acceptor goes first, then the donor. So the standard voltage is minus 0.219 voltage, minus a minus 0.135 voltage, and you get a change in voltage of 0.096 volts. From that, you can then go and plug that into the delta G equation. You can do the same thing here, write them in appropriate half reactions and give the correct voltage according to how you have that. For NADH, which undergoes oxidation rather than reduction, the half reaction is reversed of the one given in table 14.5, and its delta value is then given a positive. You end up with the same voltage. You plug that into the value here. You have two electrons being transferred at a time. There's a Faraday constant, joule volt per mole, and you get that times that voltage, and you get, so there's a typo there, negative 1.85 negative value. Boy, I need to sit down and take a nap, apparently. Negative 18.5 kilojoules. There's a typo there, obviously. That is it. Thank you very much. We will see you on tomorrow, and I'll have chapter 15 ready for you. It's already there. We'll get done with chapter 15, and it'll all be good. I'll upload the rest of them. Thank you.